Call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. It is April 3rd, 1991, 3:43 p.m. Present are Senators Pierce, Eliason, Collins, and Halper. We have before us today Senate Bills 184, 208, 212, 227. We will be bringing Senate Bill 95 back up. We are on teleconference, so we do need to use the microphones. We have people teleconferencing for Senate Bill 208 and Senate Bill 184. Senator Lashen, why don't we go ahead and take your Senate Bill 208 first?
Are you on teleconference? Let's go.
Yes, sir. We have people in Sitka, fancy that, who want to testify on 208.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 208 would provide workers' compensation coverage to volunteer emergency medical technicians who are injured during the course of providing services outside an incorporated city or borough. This legislation was in Senate Bill 508, an omnibus workers' compensation bill last year and passed the Senate. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 508 died in the House for reasons not connected with this provision. Senate Bill 208 has the support of the Department of Labor and Health and Social Services, and a zero fiscal note has been submitted by the Division of Risk Management. The gross weekly earnings of an injured EMT is based on earnings paid a full-time EMP, employed in the city or borough nearest to the place where the injury occurred. In no case will the gross weekly earnings be less than the minimum wage computed on the basis of a 40-hour week. I believe we have people here to testify on the bill, Madam Chair.
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
I failed to note that you have the zero fiscal note and also a position paper from Department of Health and Social Services and two additional pieces of paper from one from Southeast Region EMS, both from Southeast Region EMS for your file that were on to your right underneath that file of stuff for 95. Let's go first here in Juneau to Mark Johnson.
This is wrong about medical.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm Chief of the Emergency Medical Services Section of the Department of Health and Social Services. And we are in favor of this bill. We would just note that under Alaska Statute 2330.92, municipalities can provide workers' compensation coverage for volunteers within their jurisdiction. And we feel it's only fair to those volunteers who are residing outside of municipalities in the state that they should have the same coverage. And under this bill, that would be provided by the state. And we also note that so far, we've been very lucky, and the experience among our volunteers has been that there have been few injuries connected with providing emergency services, and we hope that continues. But we also think that providing this coverage will help in terms of recruitment and retention of volunteers in the remote rural areas of this state.
Thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go to Sitka now, and first, Craig Lewis.
Question. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Lewis. I reside at 1112 Lake Drive in North Pole. I'm visiting in Sitka and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm currently the president of the Alaska Emergency Medical Services Corporation and Association, and also the executive director of Interior Region Emergency Medical Services. This is a very important bill, and I think one that rightfully recognizes and supports the backbone of Alaska's EMS system, specifically the volunteers that provide health care for their neighbors. Many of them are take on at their own risk, responding along the highways or often very rural communities, just to make sure that those in need get the kind of need that they deserve. I strongly support Mr. Johnson's statements regarding the recruitment side of things, as well as the fact that we do have a quality control system in place that emphasizes safety, and I think by having that in place, we will be protected to have to deal with this. So I strongly urge that you support this particular Senate Bill 208. As a matter of aside information, in my own region of the state, we have 58 communities. Of those 58, only 16 are incorporated. So that'll give you an idea of the large group of people that this potentially can help. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Lewis? Okay, we'll go on to Reed Reynolds, please.
I have a question.
Also in Sitka. Just a moment, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Reed Reynolds. I'm with the Southeast Region Emergency Medical Service Council. I'm here today to report to you that March 18th of this year, the 30-member regional board for Southeast Region EMS Council voted unanimously to endorse and support this bill and express their appreciation to Senator Eliason for his leadership. I would secondly call your attention to the fact that in Southeast there are 40 communities, of which 18 are incorporated, 22 unincorporated, greater than 50%. In these 22 unincorporated communities, we estimate the population to be 7,500 people, or 15% of the total population. This population generates approximately 200 requests for emergency medical service annually out of 4,000, approximately 4-5% of the total emergency service volume in the region. This 5% implies that there's minimal risk to the EMS workers who would be protected by this bill. This protection would be for greater than 50% of the communities, would preserve the volunteer EMS system, and would in fact preserve a significant investment in the training of these volunteers. If we can retain these volunteers, we avoid the cost, significant cost, I might add, of retraining new people. In summary, we are very much in support of this bill and urge your endorsement. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Reynolds? Ma'am, do you want to testify on the bill?
I have a statement to make about, you said medical there. Well, this is a proper use, a correct use of the word medicines. Wilderness medicines, health of plants of the far north. Chemicals and stuff like that is not scriptural, but medicines, helpful plants of the far north or in around the world is the correct usage. And I bought this for $9.95 and I wrote a letter about it. I sent it to Tony Knowles, but he didn't get in, so I guess he's in Anchorage. So they'll be working with their plants and things, I hope, better like that. Because we found that chemicals are inert substances, but the medicines, the plants that grow, are the ones that really work well as medicines and foods. Most of our foods are veggies, like veggie meals, or the animals eat plants.
Ma'am, do you want to testify on Senate Bill 208, which is the bill we have before us?
Well, about medical, and I work with on criminology, criminal problems, and how to work with those ideas.
Okay, well,
statement.
Okay, I'm sorry, but we're taking testimony on the bill, not statements on other things.
Well, this is, he just said medical, so this is important.
Okay, we'll go to Valdez now, to Charles Lundfelt.
Good afternoon. My name is Charles Lundfelt. I am the fire chief of the city of Valdez, and I'm president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I appreciate this opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 208. The State Fire Chiefs Association is very pleased to see this bill. However, we have some concerns that we would like to see addressed prior to its passage. We note that the bill allows for volunteer emergency medical technicians in unincorporated areas to be considered as employees of the state and therefore receive workman's compensation. The concern that we have with this bill, one of the major concerns we have, is that it does not address rescue workers or firefighters who are also volunteers in unincorporated areas that may be at the same emergency scene with these emergency medical technicians. The concern we would have would be that in the event of several injuries at the same scene, we would only have the EMTs in this area being covered and not the firefighters or the rescue workers. Several years ago, the International Association of Fire Chiefs was able to get through some legislation that allowed us to have the Federal Death Benefit Act for firefighters. We did something similar to this bill in the fact that we had a program that would allow for the insurance of firefighters in the event of death on the line. We had forgotten about the EMTs when we passed this legislation, and the result was that firefighters killed in the line of duty were covered, but EMTs were not. I see a similarity in this Senate bill, however, just in the reverse. It would be possible for a volunteer EMT squad and a volunteer fire department then to respond to a scene, but only half of them be covered. So I have some very, very big concerns about this one particular aspect. You might note that AS 2330092 addresses volunteer ambulance attendants, policemen, and firemen. This was amended to include include ambulance attendants and policemen in 1971 to include them into what was originally just a firefighter bill. Secondly, we have some concerns about the fact that unincorporated areas are not the only areas where you have unprotected volunteer rescue and fire and EMS squads. In a number of the second-class boroughs, several of the rescue squads and the volunteer fire departments are not part of a service area or a tax base and are basically working in a manner that's very similar to the departments that are in the unincorporated areas, and we suggest that this also be looked at and addressed. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Like I said in my original testimony, in fact, this bill was around last year, and up until an hour ago, I didn't realize that volunteer firemen were even wanting to be a part of this bill. And that's certainly not because we wanted to leave you out, just because someone failed to inform the Senate that these people were interested in getting into this particular protection. However, I suggested to the chairperson of the committee that we hold this bill for a week where we could address the volunteer firemen. However, I'm rather amazed that until this last minute, we've received no correspondence whatsoever from the fire departments on this issue.
Mr. Lundfeld, do you have any response to that?
No, ma'am. On behalf of the State Fire Chiefs Association, we'd be more than happy to work with the senator and his committee on any changes that would be necessary to this bill.
Great. Senator Halford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to that concern, one of the things that makes this work for emergency medical technicians is that they are certified by the state, and we need some kind of a key in to be able to tie other emergency personnel to some kind of a process. Otherwise, you're going to have after-the-fact claims based on whoever happened to be responding to whatever the emergency happened to be, whether they be firefighters, emergency medical technicians, or other helpers. If we want to cover them, I think you've got to cover them in some other way than an exemption like this. This is stretching to get by without a fiscal note. We had firefighters. There's, somewhere risk management is going to say it costs somebody something. And if we don't have a definition, we know it's going to cost money. So I would hope the firefighters would give us some kind of a certification process or some kind of citation in statute that we can use if we're going to include them in the bill.
Mr.
Senator, this is Chief Lundfeld. Other areas of the state statutes that deal with fire departments generally recognize fire departments that are recognized by the state fire marshal's office. We're required to register the departments each year and send in a roster of our members.
So essentially, we could refer to firefighters who are listed on the roster of membership through approved fire departments that are listed with the fire marshal in?
That's affirmative. I think that might be a possible answer to Senator Halford's concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you. To Senator
Blyton. Thank you. I just had one question. You mentioned numerous concerns of the bill, but are you concerned that the EMTs are getting this coverage? How do you address that specific instance? Do you support them as being a part of this or not?
Absolutely. We support this bill, and we think it's an excellent idea, and it is unfortunate that we were not aware that this was coming up. We can thank the Legislative Affairs Office for giving this information out to us and giving us a chance to comment on it. But by all means, we support the concept of the bill and the support that you're showing for the volunteer emergency medical technicians.
Thank you. In Ketchikan, Peggy Inkwood.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Peggy Entwood, and I'm the EMS captain for the Ketchikan Fire Department. I'm also the vice president for Southeast Region EMS Corporation, which is based in Sitka. I came to talk to you today to thank Senator Larson for submitting this bill, for having the opportunity to speak. I've lived in Southeast Alaska all of my life and have been involved in emergency medical services for more than 11 years, although all of that involvement has been here in Ketchikan. My activities with Southeast Region EMS Corporation include sitting on the board of directors, also include regional training for EMS personnel in many communities in Southeast. As Reed Reynolds commented to you earlier, 22 communities in Southeast Alaska alone are not incorporated cities. And although the call volume for those 22 communities is relatively small. Those volunteers in those communities responding to the to that relatively small number of calls are also those volunteers who may be responding with higher risk than personnel in cities like Ketchikan, for example, because in many instances, they're going into the woods to treat and transport injured folks. They're working with limited equipment, with poor communication capabilities, and sometimes not always the chance to have all of the training that's available in larger communities. These folks in some circumstances are homemakers who don't have outside employment and have no way to compensate themselves if they're injured. So I fully support this bill. I'm pleased to see it happen, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. To Barrow, to Mike Clay, Claywitter. Is Barrow online? We've apparently lost them. Let's go to Homer, to Robert Purcell.
Yes, this is Robert Purcell. I want to thank you for holding this hearing. I'm here representing our fire department here in Homer, the Homer Volunteer Fire Department, and I feel I can speak for some of our other small departments in the area. I'm also a member of the board of directors for the Alaska State Fire Chiefs Association, so I may echo some of the comments of Chief Lundfeld. I'm very pleased to see this bill. I think it's an excellent idea and deserves the support of everyone. I have a very deep personal philosophy that we have a responsibility as a society to protect those people who give their time freely to protect us. And that's something we try to institute in our own organization as far as safety and equipment. And I think this is a step that state can take to do that on our behalf. I do encourage you to look strongly at broadening this bill to include firefighters and members of recognized rescue squads so that it is all-encompassing. This is a little bit discriminatory in a sense. I understand how that came about. It was basically drafted from the EMS folks, and they were looking to that very important issue of the EMTs who do travel around the state. I'd also like to comment on this concern with the second-class boroughs, which is something that I brought up with Chief Lundfeld earlier today. The borough here in the Kenai has many small departments like Hope and Cooper Landing and others that provide EMS on a very basic level on sections of our highway system. But they are not service areas, and they're really not part of a municipal or governmental entity in any real sense. They're locally supported, and they may receive state grants or other pass-through funds like that, but there's no tax base supporting them. And I think that this bill ought to extend to those kinds of people, and I think language to include or to define those people into the bill would be appropriate. In other words, it would apply to all organizations not part of municipal entities or directly receiving the majority of their funding from municipal entities, whether they be cities or boroughs. And my third area of concern was one on the calculation of workman's comp. It's a bigger issue we've been talking about. I thought I'd like to bring it to your attention. Please note that although we're extending workman's comp to these individuals, it may not be proportionate to the workman's comp they're receiving at work. For example, if one of these EMTs, someone who worked in the slope or was a successful fisherman, their income might be substantially higher than the what the workman's comp would compensate them for. In other words, they're going to be calculated on a EMT salary, which might be anywhere from 28 to 32,000, which would, I think it'd be something like two-thirds of that with the other adjustment. If they made 60 or 70,000 on the slope, and their payments were that, so on and so forth, somebody could go out there, hurt their back, be off work 6 months, effectively lose their home, cars, etc., and it could be a major blow. We're recommending that the Workman's Comp Act be looked at in general and see if that calculation can't be based on calculations as an EMT or firefighter, as presently written in this bill, or at their regular job, whichever is greater, and that would assure them of some protection. We do have some volunteers who have a very real concern that in effect they could be forced into bankruptcy if they're injured functioning as a volunteer in our communities. So I think some consideration should be given to that. And I would like to emphasize that I think we could provide an adequate definition of a firefighter or rescue person and would narrow it down and focus it to people who are certified as firefighter ones or members of recognized fire departments as recognized by the fire marshal's office or something like that. It would clearly define who's eligible for this program, and I understand that concern.
Senator Collins.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I do have some questions about the bill, and it relates to the compensation aspects of it. And Mr. Purcell, as long as he's brought it up, I'm going to ask my questions. But I did have a concern about that section, Senator Eliason, and the concern is what Mr. Purcell is saying is correct, but it could work both ways. You could have someone who was making a very high salary and becomes injured, and then their compensation level is completely inadequate because it's based on a salary which is significantly lower than that of their regular job. On the other hand, you could have an individual who is winds up being compensated at a higher level because their regular job it pays a lot less than the EMT position. So I think that you need to look a little bit at how that compensation is going to be structured, because you could have both situations where you have, in some cases, some people being paid too much and some people being, you know, not being paid enough. And I think that will create some problems, and I'd like to see us address it before we move the bill out of committee. I don't have any language for it right now, but I think it's something that needs to be addressed.
And in Glen Allen, Cherie Ansell.
Yes, this is Cherie Ansell. I'm the administrator for Copper River EMS here in the Copper River Basin, and also treasurer for Southern Region EMS Council Board of Directors. I appreciate the fact that Senator Eliason has introduced this bill, and our board of directors is very supportive of this bill. I also am speaking today as a representative for four local fire departments representing over 100 firefighters, and they had the same concern as Charlie Lundfeld had in that they should be added to this bill. We have no tax base of any kind in the Copper River Basin. We represent over 20 communities in the area. At this time, Copper River EMS Council provides worker compensation insurance for our volunteers. Last year, we paid $7,600 for 39 volunteers. This year, we have managed to nearly double the number of volunteers that we have within our service area, up to 70 volunteers, and that's going to double our insurance rate to at least $215,000. We're concerned that we won't be able to pay this if this continues, and we will have to discontinue providing worker compensation for our volunteers should this bill not pass. We will have to discontinue, and our volunteers will also be without coverage. We cover over 600 miles of major highway, and although our population is only 4,000, we probably have at any given time during the summer months an additional 15,000 to 20,000 people in our service area. We're very concerned about this, and we support this measure entirely.
Thank you very much. And in the Mat-Su, we have Rosita Hendricks. Is Matsu online?
Hi, this is Rosita Henderson of Matsu Borough. I am speaking strictly for myself today, as thanks to the legislative office here, I was just informed of this bill. I do support it, but I do see some of the concerns that the others do. I would ask that you do address some of these other concerns. I do thank Senator Allison for the bill. It is a good one. But let's see if we can help the other people too. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Is there anyone else in the teleconference network who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 208 today?
Yes, I'm Mark Barker from the City of Bethel. I'm the fire chief for the City of Bethel, and I'd just like to echo Robert Purcell and Chief Lundfeld's concerns. I'm also on the board of directors for the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, and I came today to talk about the things that I see are missing, the firefighter things, and maybe the non-certified emergency medical people. I think they pretty much covered all my concerns fairly well. I do support the bill totally. We do have a large number of unincorporated villages out here, and I'd just like to see if we could add in that extra wording, and I think we'd be good and off running.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else in the teleconference network who'd like to speak on 208?
I'm from Haines. We have a teleconference there.
Ma'am, I'm sorry. We're just taking testimony on 208. And with that, we'll close the teleconference hearing. Senator Larson, would you be willing to work with Senator Collins on the bill and bring it back to us on the 12th, which is a week from Friday?
Madam Chair, I think that, well, number one, I'd like to say that we're not excluding anyone from this bill on purpose. We're unaware of the fact that there are so many volunteer firemen who want to be a part of this. I would hope that we had heard a little bit sooner about the situation. However, I think that it merits some investigation. I'm not sure how you're going to determine which ones are going to be covered and which ones aren't. I think it's important that people be certified, be on record as being volunteers for that particular service. Number two, I don't know how we're going to deal with the gross weekly earnings. I think we're going from zero to whatever it might be, which is a big plus. And I don't know if we can be able to determine if it's fair. It's certainly fair for two individuals who are out there in these areas and at both at risk, and one of them is injured and one is not, or if they're both injured, one would get less money than the other one. I don't think that's fair. I think they both should be compensated. How we're going to make those adjustments, I don't know. But I'm certainly willing to look at the bill and try to include those volunteer groups. I think it's important that these people get our support. However, I would hope that we can resolve this as quickly as possible and move this bill along. I think it's important that we don't let it bog down again this year like we did last year. And I would certainly hope we could resolve these questions before Friday and next week. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. I think so. I'm not sure. I don't remember what I asked. This one. Okay, then we will plan to have 208 back up on the 12th. Let's go next to Senate Bill 227, extending the Correctional Industries Program. A sunset bill. Prime sponsor is Senator Kurtula. Is Senator Kurtula's staff present? Okay. Well, it is straight sunset, changing July 1st, 1991 to 1995. We have Wally Roman from the Department of Corrections, and I see that we have the Commissioner. Commissioner Haynes, you are welcome to join us if you'd like to testify, or?
Oh,
assistant. Okay. Terrific. Thank you. We do not have anyone on teleconference wishing to testify on 226. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Wally Roman. I serve as the Correctional Industries Manager, or General Manager of the Correctional Industries Program for the Department of Corrections. I also serve as staff for the Correctional Industries Commission. The Department of Corrections supports passage of Senate Bill 227 to extend the Correctional Industries Program. Alaska Correctional Industries is dedicated to the rehabilitation of prisoners by providing employment and realistic work experiences. It's very important that the Correctional Industries program provides a strong management tool for providing meaningful activity in the prisons, thus reducing inmate idleness. Currently, all 50 states, the federal government, and Canada operate correctional industry programs nationwide. It has turned into a $600 million a year plus industry nationwide, employing 57,400 inmates in all 50 states. Approximately 10% of the nation's incarcerated population is employed in correctional industry programs. In Alaska, and on average, Alaska Correctional Industries employs 160 inmates within its programs operations. This represents employment of approximately 6% of the state's incarcerated inmate population. Since the program's inception in 1982, the program has continued to expand, and now in fiscal year 1991, operates 8 industries in 6 separate locations. The products and services produced by ACI are available to local, state, federal government, school districts, and nonprofit organizations. In FY90, the Correctional Industries Program generated approximately $2 million in gross sales. More importantly, $1.6 was expended to attain this level of sales, with $1.3 million, or 83% of the total, was purchased from Alaska vendors. 262 Alaskan vendors were involved in these purchases by ACI. This year's to-date gross sales figures as of February was established at approximately $1.2 million for all operations. Projections for this fiscal year's gross sales is anticipated to reach $2.3 million. Madam Chair, I could go through the individual eight operations that we have in place in six locations. This ties into Senate Bill 184 also, or I could just answer questions.
Why don't you go ahead and go through them quickly, because I suspect that the next testimony they're going to be brought up anyway.
Okay, thank you very much. First operation Glass Correctional Industry has is the commercial laundry operation here in Juneau. That employs 29 inmates, and we have one staff member. Primarily, 97% of that operation supports the Alaska Marine Highway operation and laundry. In Kenai, we have a metal products division, which produces a standard product line of things like barbecue grills, bear-proof trash cans. But more importantly, there we have fabricated jail furniture for our institutions, primarily Spring Creek back in 87, which offset the cost of all the equipment in that operation. We also have a furniture plant in Kenai. This plant produces oak furniture, computer tables, dorm furniture. Recently, we've been approved to produce office panel systems by the commission. The furniture operation in Kenai is now in the process of being transferred to Seward because of the fire marshal's restrictions on our operations at Kenai. And it is hoped that the office panel systems operation will employ up to the 30 individuals we currently have employed in Kenai. Currently, beginning the operation in Seward, we have 24 inmates employed, and they will take over the oak furniture line. In Fairbanks, we have a garment flat goods shop, which primarily produces inmate garments and flat goods, and right now that's restricted to Department of Corrections use only. It supports the inmate usage of these products. In Palmer, we have an auto body repair shop that employs six people. Basically, it repairs vehicles for the DOT equipment fleet. They do body paint, frame straightening, and we're looking at the possibility now of doing some heavy equipment refurbishing. Also at Palmer, we have agricultural operations that employ 10 inmates. They operate a farm and a greenhouse. Last year they produced 350 tons of potatoes and miscellaneous vegetable items that were used within the prison system. Mount McKinley Meats is also located in Palmer. That employs 28 inmate individuals and employees, and it operates as the only full-time state-inspected slaughterhouse in the state of Alaska. Again, it ties so closely into 184, right?
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Roman? Thank you very much, sir. Risa Gerald?
Native herbs are very important, too, in gardening and agribusiness.
Ma'am, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to ask you to leave if you keep interrupting.
These are very important. I'm a George Washington representative.
Risa?
Ignorant native has some information missing here that I know about. She asked her questions, and that's what I was going to say. Shh. I want to talk about EMT, emergency medical technician.
Madam Chair?
20 years ago.
Yes.
That's why they don't like those emergency technicians.
We've lost transmission, or?
No, Risa hasn't started yet.
Excuse me.
No problem. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Risa Gerald, and I represent the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We have 5,240 member firms across the state of Alaska. Our legislative agenda is set a little differently than most associations. It's set on the poll that is done at our membership every year, and we go from there. In 1988, we posed the question to our members about unfair competition from state agencies. And that should legislation be enacted to restrict commercial activities of government entities so they are not permitted to compete with existing private enterprise? And 78% of our members that responded said yes. Most recently, we asked them a similar question: should a task force be created to study and make recommendations to limit competition from state agencies? And interestingly enough, it was down to 67% of them said yes, with a lot of comments saying, we don't need any more dadgum task forces. So I should have thought of a different way of posing the question. Mr. Roman has outlined the types of activities they have their prisoners involved with.
a lot of those type of activities, our private enterprise also is out there. They have one, their slaughter plant up north, everybody points to it as being an activity for the prisoners that doesn't compete with private industry. It fills a void the private industry has not taken up. And we encourage them to do things of that nature. We would make a couple of suggestions. The commission only has one private sector person on it. We would suggest that the commission be expanded to have an additional person on it. It also has an even number of people, six. So when there's like committees of any kind, it would be, I think, more appropriate for it to be an odd number, so it would bring it up to seven and two private sector persons only there. We also would encourage the department to enter into more joint ventures. As Mr. Roman has said, only 6% of the population is employed, and I've heard testimony from Mr. Roman before and some others that it's important to have these people busy so you don't have riots and setting fires to their mattresses or whatever they do because they're bored and everything. And so if they have, could expand the industries into areas that don't compete with private industry, we try to help them out and see if we can work together. We would suggest instead of extending them for 1995, to extend them just 1 year, the commission, and see how we can work more cooperatively together in that period of time. And essentially, that's my basic testimony.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Lyons.
I have one question. Does the NFIB have any suggestions on what type of industries these person should be involved in? Any specific?
No, not at this time, no. I was thinking about probably sending out a questionnaire of asking members about ideas for joint ventures and that sort of thing when session is over with, and we're not here by the guest.
I sat through a number of these in the past, and we're trying to do things for the correctional institutions, try to keep them busy, trying to bring them out as different citizens.
Sure.
And I failed to have anybody come forward and suggest, let's do this particular program because it interferes with somebody else out there who might not even be there. So I think it would be of immense value if you, if your group, the small business people in Alaska, would make some definite suggestions on what industries these people can be involved in.
I have suggested that myself and some of the other groups, associations that are working on this issue, that we get together and come up with some specific ideas. Commissioner Haynes is a very sincere man and wants to do things for, and I like him too, sneak on. But and I'd like to help him do his job, and it's not an easy job having to run the prisons and all, and we would want to help and work with them, just so long as it doesn't hurt some small business person. And there's bound to be ideas out there. We probably can contact some national something that are pick and choose things. So we don't have a whole bunch of business, variety of businesses. They were always talking about diversification. So there's bound to be something they can do that won't compete with businesses that exist. So we're willing to want to help.
Senator Halpin.
I've always thought the starting point would be everything that we contract outside of the state.
I think there's a bill in the other body that kind of does something like that.
Could you get them to make pull tabs?
No.
Other than that.
The bar business? How about the banking business?
Pull tabs. Thank you. Joe Ford.
Okay, that's where we should put them. Chips.
Take a couple fishing with me. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Poor. I'm the Executive Director for the General Chamber of Commerce. Listening to Senator Elias, I didn't cover it in this particular aspect. In response to your question, we made a proposal to the Department of Corrections as a way of continuing the existing program, and this was specifically to do with the furniture manufacturing operation, in which we made a suggestion that they continue manufacturing in a manufacturing capacity. But instead of the current requirement where it's mandated that the state will buy any product produced by the Department of Corrections, which bypasses the competitive bid process, that they manufacture and then they develop their marketing plan, offer quantity discounts, and sell it to the Alaska retail trade. So it becomes a source of supply for the existing retail trade and allows the private sector to participate in programs or purchases made by the state of Alaska. So that may help a little bit on what some of the things that we're working on. We're trying to find a way because we do value the vocational training necessary for some of the inmates. As I mentioned, I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 227. It says, we, the Greater Juneau Chamber of Commerce, do not believe that the state of Alaska should compete with the private sector for public business. This situation currently exists within the programs of the Department of Corrections. We have the following concerns with the Department of Corrections program. One, recognizing the importance of vocational training for inmates within the prison system, we feel that some of the existing programs do not train inmates for jobs currently available within the state of Alaska. If Alaska taxpayers are paying for this program, inmates should be trained for locations that exist within our state. Two, we do not feel the composition of the existing corrections board provides adequate representation from the private sector. Since this commission authorizes the Department of Corrections to enter or expand commercial revenue-generating programs that may compete with the private sector, it is paramount that adequate representation from the private sector be present on this board. We feel if the board composition cannot be balanced, then perhaps the program should be allowed to sunset. Three, we feel the board should be mandated to revisit each prison program at least every 2 years to ensure that the intent of the law is met, specifically the provision that there is a minimal negative impact to the private sector. Four, we are not aware of any appeal process that can be initiated by the private sector to get a fair hearing if it appears that the minimal negative impact has been exceeded. The appeal process should be a provision for reversal of the Department of Corrections actions. Five, there appears to be a communication problem to provide adequate notice to the business community impacted by the programs, those either changed or proposed by the Department of Corrections. The existing notice procedures may be in compliance with the state public notice guidelines, but are in practice totally inadequate. Last month, during the teleconference with the Department of Corrections commissioners, we requested that notice of upcoming meetings that will result in program changes be distributed through the Alaska Chambers of Commerce, in addition to the existing notification procedures. We have offered to provide the Department of Corrections with the addresses of each known Chamber of Commerce within the state of Alaska. Six, finally, please remember that Alaska cannot be compared with the correction programs in the lower 48. Our state of Alaska is one of the largest employers within our state and plays a major role in our economic health, whereas in the lower 48, state government purchases is a minimal contributor to their total economic stability. According to our information, the corrections program in the lower 48 coming under attack by the private sector as they realize the significance of this program. We do not need more government-sponsored competition. We request that you do not extend the existing program beyond an effective date of July 1, 1992 to give adequate time to resolve the concerns of Alaska's private business sector impacted by this legislation. If these concerns cannot be satisfied, then we request that this program be allowed to sunset. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Ford, Senator Life.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm just curious. If you say that you feel that the jobs are trained for do not exist in Alaska.
Some of the vocational training programs, yes, sir, do not. They do not exist except within the Department of Corrections program.
Well, how can they be in competition with private industry if jobs don't exist out there to start with?
No, what we're saying is they shouldn't be trained for a job that does not exist in the private sector within the state of Alaska.
That's so
the question is that you're saying that they're competing for the private sector.
Oh, all right.
So if you're training for a job, there's nobody out there in the private sector doing that. That's what you're saying.
That's well, that's okay. That's a good example would be, just like I mentioned, as far as the furniture manufacturing business. Okay, we're teaching them to assemble or manufacture office panel systems, one example. But other than the Department of Corrections, we don't have a manufacturer here in the state of Alaska. Okay? And we're not saying that that's a competitor, because in a sense it's not. But as a general rule, we do object to the public sector competing with the private sector for public business.
And you're proposing that rather than sell it to the state of Alaska, they sell it to public at large, the furniture? And then they turn around and sell it to the state? Is that what you're saying?
That could be one. It could also be sold to the private sector, but allows them to be trained.
Senator Collins.
Madam Chair, if I may, Mr. Porter is absolutely correct. The jobs for which the inmates are being trained in the correctional system do not generally exist in the labor market, and their chance of being employed upon completion of this program is very, very limited in the Alaska market. The programs that have been identified are pretty consistent with the labor markets in the lower 48 states, but they're not consistent with Alaska's labor market. And I would say that you're absolutely correct. They're not real jobs. Senator Halper.
But that gets them to where the problem is. We can't have both standards. If one standard is not to compete with the private sector, that means we can't create the jobs that are available in the private sector,
exactly,
or train people for the things that are available in the private sector. If the other standard is that they have to have, you know, they have to be in something they can utilize in the state, if they can utilize it in the state, it's because there is somebody in the private sector hiring people in that job, and then we've defined them to be in competition. I mean, those two criteria are mutually exclusive. We can't win that way.
Well, what we were trying to do was work within the existing system. The existing system was the fact that whatever I manufacture, this seems to be the approach, whatever I manufacture has to be purchased by the state, therefore we're going to continue manufacturing goods, even though they're not training them. I'm just looking specifically at this one segment. It doesn't apply uniformly across all the other areas in which they're, you know, they're training people. Sorry.
No, I think it depends on what your goal is. You know, if your goal is to provide these people with a vocational training option so that they can be employed once they leave the prison system, this program is not doing it. And if that's the reason the program exists, then it needs to be discontinued. If the program exists to give people something to do, then that's a different thing. But in the meantime, you have a program that doesn't really work, isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, but it's creating some problems for the private sector. And so as far as I'm concerned, the program needs to be significantly revamped if it's to continue to be a benefit.
Any other questions for Mr. Ford? Thank you, sir. I understand that there are a number of people on the teleconference waiting to testify on Senate Bill 184 who are also interested in Senate Bill 227. In the interest of time, and because neither bill will be moving from committee today, we will wait and take testimony after we bring 184 up, and you'll be able to speak to both. Roger Lewis, please.
We have meaning platforms to pay back innocent victims.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
I would like to say a question or an interview.
My name is Roger Lewis. I'm a member of the commission. I live at 635 Main Street in Juneau. I'm the business representative on the commission. I've served for a little over four and a half years. I would like to, of course, support Correction Industries. I'm very proud to be part of it. We're now considered one of the up-and-comers within the 50 states in that we run a relatively exemplary system. We have extended the membership of the board about a year and a half ago to include two labor representatives. Possibly, what Mr. Porter was saying, possibly we could extend it to include two business representatives. I would not be unhappy with that. However, are we doing both bills together or just the sunset now?
We're just doing the sunset.
Okay, just the sunset. I think that it serves a very valuable purpose. It conforms with the public purpose of import substitution, since most of our stuff is manufacturing. It conforms with the public purpose of good correctional management. I think corrections pretty much can speak to exactly what it does mean to have a correction industry within your facility. It's run by the various, we have a single industry, but it's run in each one of the different facilities by, or is determined how it operates within the facilities by the director of the facility. So it does conform with what corrections wants. I'd like to remind the committee that we are merely an advisory commission. We make no decisions whatsoever. We merely, our major task is to determine whether it in competition with if there's a minimal impact on the private industry. And since we are manufacturers, that minimal impact is almost always measured against manufacturing. We don't get into sales. We don't broker someone else's materials. We're not a dealer for an outside manufacturer. Therefore, we usually don't weigh possibly as heavily as we should the impact upon our industries, upon the brokers and dealers of the state, which, of course, it's very difficult to measure that. We do measure it against whether it's interfering with some other manufacturer. That's something we can get a handle on. We can actually make a determination on that. So we've had, in Alaska, only about 5 to 7% of our general economy is based on manufacturing. So in that regard, we're a perfect sort of industry. We compete very little because there is so little made in Alaska at the present time. At hopefully 20 years down the road, when 25% of our economy is manufacturing, we will have a much more difficult time recommending industries that do not compete with the private industry.
I just have a question. Would you address the situation where you're damned if you're doing, you're damned if you don't?
Well,
about
yes,
jobs,
sir.
You know.
We've people are mixing oranges and apples here. An industry that whenever you weigh an industry, for instance, if you want to get into meat packing, what we do is weigh against anybody else who's in the slaughtering and meat packing business, who has a kill floor and has a U.S. FDA stamp. Obviously, there's none of them like that in Alaska. But if you try to weigh it against, so we can weigh it against those other people who are engaged in that manufacturing industry, the manufacturing of meat products. If we try to weigh it against those people who sell meat products and who represent Hormel or represent other meat products outside, obviously you'll never have an industry created. You will always be in competition because brokers and sellers and dealers, everything that is that we consume in Alaska, obviously, except for the 5% that we make here, is made somewhere else. So by definition, we will always be in competition, and by definition, the minimal impact rule would require that we make a recommendation to the Commissioner of Corrections that we not engage in that industry. In the case of the damned if you do, damned if you don't, if we did have to consider everyone who does or potentially does broker, deal, or sell a product in Alaska, then it's kind of where anybody with a $25 business license would put us out of business. We would indeed be in competition.
Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and take up Senate Bill 184. We do have the prime sponsor, Senator Duncan.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I will give a brief explanation of the bill overview. I apologize, I'm going to have to leave. I have a meeting at 4:05 that I need to be at. First of all, I'd like to assure you that this bill has none of the controversy surrounding it that the Sunset Bill probably had. This is very special.
And why are there more people
that testify? I have no idea. Very straightforward piece of legislation. Actually, Senate Bill 184 is an attempt to address concerns that have been expressed to me by private enterprise in our state, and a lot of those concerns have come from this community with the Correctional Industries Program. Let me say at the outset, I think the Correctional Industries Program is important. I've supported that in the past and continue to support the program. However, I think it is important to look at what the status of that program is at the present time and how it may be coming into conflict or into competition with the private sector and see if we can't take some steps to eliminate that difficulty. Current law, as I'm sure you've heard today, directs the Department of Corrections to establish programs which have minimal negative impact on existing private industry or labor force in the state. I'm not completely comfortable that the Correctional Industries Commission has adequately gauged the impact in all cases, the impact on existing private industry or labor force in the state. I have some specific concerns about, for example, the furniture manufacturing program, and I came in late to this hearing, but I understand it has been specifically mentioned already. And during the summer months, during the interim, I made several appeals to the Department of Corrections and the Commission to review the impact of the program and did not get what I consider to be a satisfactory response, although I would say I appreciate the time that the department spent with me and my staff discussing the program. For example, there have been changes in the furniture manufacturing industry since its institution in 1982. That's when the program was first instituted by the Commission. Initially, distribution of products was limited to South Central Alaska. Since that time, distribution has been expanded to include Southeast Alaska, and a recent decision was made by the Commission to expand the program to include the manufacturing of systems furniture. It's not clear in my mind that the Commission ever took steps to properly gauge the impact of this change in the program, one from change in geographical area, and secondly, expanding into the manufacturing of systems furniture. I'm not comfortable that they gauge the impact on private enterprise through public hearing process when it expanded the program and changed its direction. And that's one of the major provisions, or one of the provisions in this legislation. Section 1 adds new language requiring the Commission to conduct a public hearing before it enters into a new industry or expands an existing industry. And it's not clear in the present statute that requirement is there, and there was not, as far as we can tell, a public hearing as such to announce the change of geographic areas that the furniture industry program would be operating in, or to gauge the public impact when they expanded it to include the manufacturing of systems furniture. Section 2, which I believe probably will generate the most discussion, and as I heard the testimony here earlier, probably already has, would repeal AS 3332030C, subsection C. That repeal would eliminate requirements for state agencies to purchase correctional industry products or services. Private enterprise views this section of the current law as unfair competition. I think that's an issue that does bear discussion by the legislature and by the committee. There may be a better way to handle it than what is presently in statute. Again, I wouldn't say that perhaps even a complete repeal is a proper method, but I hope by getting this issue on the table and discussing it, we can come to some type of an agreement where we will eliminate the problem that appears to be there. As I said, I've had numerous contacts with the Department of Corrections over the past several months regarding concerns. Haven't been completely satisfied that those have been resolved, and that's why I introduced the bill and I brought it before you, and hope that through the committee process and discussion with the department, with commission members, and with those concerned from the private sector, that we can resolve the issues that have been brought to my attention. I think they are worthy of committee consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Duncan? Thank you very much for being with us. Mr. Roman.
Madam Chair, for the record again, my name is Wally Roman. I'm the Correctional Industries Manager for the Department of Corrections and Service Staff to the Correctional Industries Commission. As indicated in the department's position paper, the Department of Corrections respectfully cannot support the passage of Senate Bill 184. The department believes this bill would reduce the effectiveness of the current correctional industries program, reduce the number of existing needed jobs, inmate jobs, and restrict the future development of the program's operations. Senate Bill 184, of course, would provide two functions. Senator Duncan talked about require additional public hearings and the repeal of AS 3332030C. And the Department of Corrections is most concerned with the repeal of that section of the bill. That section has been referred to as a mandatory state use law. And in summary, it means that if the correctional industries program produces a product of comparable quality and at reasonable price, as determined by the Department of Administration, they're the third party in this, then state agencies must purchase that product or service from the correctional industries program. Unfortunately, it's a common misconception, not only in Alaska, but nationwide, there's been articles written on it, that state use laws, it's the belief that state use laws are to capture 100% of any given market. In actuality, the correctional industries program operates in a very small segment of the industries. And last year, like I said, FY90, we did $2 million in gross sales. That was spread upon 8 different industries. And private sector would not focus or dilute the focus of their efforts in 8 different industries, especially as diverse as agricultural and furniture manufacturing. The primary purpose of a state use law is to just provide enough business in the prison industry shops so that we can provide a realistic work environment for the inmates. It's also to determine a primary target market so that we don't go head to head against the private sector on every order. As I said, the furniture industry has been a topic of discussion. Right now we're looking at, or recently we looked at some figures that showed that correctional industries is probably capturing in FY90 12% to 15% of the state use furniture market. And that's not considering the University of Alaska or the quasi-state agencies. So it's probably much less than that. If you incorporate, and I just got some figures today, if you incorporate office supplies into that, our percentage of the market drops down to about 3.5% of the total market used by state agencies. Again, not including the quasi-state agencies. More information on state use laws. As I said before, all 50 states now operate correctional industries programs. Of the 50 states, and we included this in your packet, we included a recent survey. 38 states or more incorporate a state use provision in their statutes. It's not unique to Alaska. Canada and the federal system also incorporate a state use law. I did my homework and tried to contacted the American Correctional Association last week, and their research section there indicated that survey is correct. I asked them what type of activity they saw in regards to state legislation passed nationwide against state use laws. There was only one, and that was specific to the state of Florida and it was specific to the printing industry. The state print shop did want to be excluded from the prison industry's legislation. There's also discussion at the national level that some of the drug bill monies are going to be incorporated to offset some of the expenses of the correctional industry's efforts nationwide. The department's position paper has major concerns. We're concerned that if we take the markets away, then we have $2.3 million in equipment and facilities now that would probably become idle. If they didn't become idle, we'd have to go toe-to-toe against the private sector on every issue, and I believe it would lead to a lot of accusations about unfair competition because of the wages that we paid our inmate workers. Also, the elimination of our existing markets right now and existing operations, we have 262 vendors out there that we're buying 83% of our raw materials and services off of in the production of our products and services. They would be out of that money, and that money might go, a majority of it might go out of the state. And in addition, the state orders for those products and services would probably be issued to out-of-state vendors. Also, because of the Curry Court settlement, it might eliminate the number of inmate jobs we have, and we might have to include some other programming for the inmates that would be added at added expense or more expense. Three specific examples, I think, will focus in on the department's concerns. I mentioned before that we have the Lennon Creek commercial laundry operation out here in Juneau. We do all of the, not all, but 97% of the Alaska Marine Highway's laundry services. Prior to us doing it in Correctional Industries, those services were provided in Prince Rupert and Seattle. There is nobody that has the size or the capacity of the operation that we currently provide out there at Lennon Creek. So if the state use law goes away, most probably Prince Rupert and Seattle will come back online and bid for those contracts. That would mean that we would have $200,000 worth of state revenues going directly out of state or worse, out of the country. We'd probably lose 25 inmate jobs, and the operating expenses that we contribute to the private sector of about $100,000 would go away. We also have $703,000 in a commercial laundry operation out there that would be difficult to use for anything else. That was the first example. The second example is, up in the valley, we operate Mount McKinley Meats. According to 1991 resolution platform as provided by the Alaska Farmers and Stockgrowers, they indicated that our Mount McKinley Meat operation provided a stable wholesale market for the Alaskan farmer and has developed a viable retail need for the Alaskan meat products. Again, if we take the state use provision away, state agencies such as the Department of Corrections, Health and Social Services, would have to go out on the open market. Probably General Services and probably would go out on the open market. In all probability, it would go back to the way it was before, and the majority of the meat furnished to these agencies would probably be out-of-state grown. We have, at Mount McKinley, we probably provide 50% of the market for the Alaskan-grown meat products. We spent about $350,000 last year in the private sector buying these animals for state agency use. Again, the passage of Senate Bill 184 could seriously impact these markets. The third example is more specific to the Fairbanks Garment Quack Hood Shop, and it shows the concern, I think, on the part of the commission and the commissioners on impact on the private sector. That industry originally was proposed as a mattress-making operation for our prisons, flat goods, sheets, blankets, etc., and clothing. Also to be provided to other state agencies, because we found that 60 to 70% of those products were being purchased out of state. Private sector was very much concerned about that, so they restricted our market. They said for 18 months you can only sell inmate clothing and flat goods to Department of Corrections only. Today, within the last year, I believe, we still purchase mattresses outside the state. In fact, it wasn't too long ago that we purchased one with a file in it that came into one of the prisons. Factory sealed into our mattresses. But the important fact is that if Senate Bill 184 takes a state provision, state use provision away, it's in all probability 60 to 70% of our own inmate clothing will be purchased from out of state. Now, within the last two months, I've been contacted by the state of Idaho and the state of Washington. They're interested in selling pressure sensitive decals that are used on our license plates and property tags in Alaska, and they're also interested in our license tag business. they would be just as interested in selling garments and flat goods to our own prison system. Now, I think it would be really a step backwards if the state use provision was taken away, and we, in turn, possibly would have to bid against Walla Walla for inmate clothing, and possibly have inmate clothing made in Walla Walla used in the state correctional system. These are all the reasons for the mandatory use of the program, or its mandatory use provision. In regards to Senate Bill 184 requiring additional public hearings, if we go way back, and I guess furniture is the one that is the most concern right now, we did hold public hearings back in 1983. We advertised, we sent letters to everybody that was in the business. Nobody showed. However, in 1986, 1987, the private sector came forth and they said, we don't want you making metal furniture. And if you make metal furniture, you're not really providing jobs for industries anyway. They were right. We got out of the metal furniture business. We decided to go back into labor-intensive products. And right now, we're a manufacturer of oak products, oak upholstered products, oak furniture. And as I said before, this is 12 to 15% of the state use market only, and only approximately 3.5% of what the state purchases, about $10 million worth of furniture and supplies a year. And that was only amongst 8 vendors. So it's even more than that, and our percentage would be lower. We produced only $455,000 worth of furniture last year. 343 of that was expense, and 73.5%, or 252,000 of those expenses, was spent within Alaska with Alaska vendors. So there's the other side. We may be taking some business away from a small portion, but we're spreading our expense revenues, or our sales revenues and production of product, across 262 vendors now. And we're starting to receive letters from our suppliers saying, hey, don't discontinue correctional industries, or if you do, let us know, because we're planning to do more business with you next year. The commission recently voted to get in the manufacture of office panels. 39 states now produce office panels for their own state agencies. In order to minimize the impact, Commissioner Haynes, 2 months ago, directed me to develop an RFP so that we could possibly work out something with the people who are currently franchising out-of-state manufactured office panels and have them handle the installation, the servicing, the handling of our accounts with state agencies. And that's not all bad, because we probably have to do that because we don't have the staff to fully operate that business in conjunction with the state agencies. It takes a lot of time. We have 11 production managers. They're directly in charge of production operations. We only have 3 people in central office. We are also promoting more involvement with the private sector. In 1989, Alaska was one of 20 states that was certified in the Prison Industry Enhancement Program by the U.S. Department of Justice. And we had a private private industry operation out at Lemon Creek for a year. That has since discontinued. But we're interested in developing new ones. We're currently negotiating with a private vendor up at Fairbanks that would have them operating an industry inside the Fairbanks Correctional Center. And with that, I have probably taken up more of your time than what you wanted, but I'll answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roman. Let me make an announcement first. I can see from the number of people that we have to testify on these two bills, and because we need to bring up Senate Bill 95 today, we will carry Senate Bill 212, the MICA bill, over until Friday. See you Friday. I won't see you Friday, but have a good time. Senator Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a couple of questions. What other programs do we have in our prison system that provide some vocational training or vocational direction for inmates?
I guess there's two ways of looking at that. In all of our operations, we have business jobs that the inmates are providing work in, bookkeepers, that type of thing, actually working on personal computers within our operations. So that's in all the operations. We're now trying to tie in educational programs with our correctional industries program. Case in point is Mount McKinley Meats. We have a meat certification program going there so that they can get a journeyman's card in a meat cutters if they have so many X number of hours of service in that industry. We have currently right now, as far as a metal fabrication operation, we are trying to develop certification for welders in that operation. So we are going towards that extent. The phrase that was used before, damn if you do, damn if you don't, really comes into play. If we focus directly on competition with the private sector, the private sector becomes unglued. So it's walking a delicate balance. It's the one of the few jobs I've ever had. If you truly have success, you probably will be without a job.
I have one more question, or two. What percentage of the inmates are involved in this process or this program?
6%. A national average is 10% right now. And if there's a target that the department has, we'd probably at least try to get to the national average. But as we increase our operations over the years since 1982, the population has gone up. So just to get to the 10% average is very difficult.
I have one more question. Given the amount of money that is being spent to provide the prison industries, in that whole exchange of dollars in terms of what the state spends to put that together, what we spend to buy the products that are manufactured, are we actually making or losing money in this whole process as a state? And I'd like to know if there is a profit, what percentage of profit you do have?
In FY90, and I'll talk to that because we closed our books out, and it depends upon which way you look at it, and I'm not trying to evade the question. If you look at our income statement, it will show that we made $108,000. However, because of the statute, the Alaska statutes, it says that we cannot charge salaries against our program. So that income statement excludes those salaries. If you take into consideration salaries, then we're actually losing money, but also, our production managers are also trained at the Corrections Academy, so they duly serve as correctional officers. And we're not in the business where we can send our workers home. We have them on site, and they'll have to go someplace. So there would probably be production managers or correctional officers supervising those people.
We'd have to house them anyway and have people serve. So actually, that's not a different expense. I guess what I'm getting at is that we're spending money to you know, give these inmates something to do and produce a product, and then we're buying the product. And as I sit here and think about it, it just makes, you know, I see all this money kind of going around in a circle, and actually maybe not the costs and benefits maybe don't match up.
There's so many goals that the correctional industry is trying to attain, and I think you touched upon that before. If we're truly trying to train them for a job afterwards, maybe we're not doing it in that every sense. But when we look at an industry, we provide the capital for getting into that industry, and that's why our profits are so low. We provide our own capital funds. In the opening of the Seward Furniture Plant, we provided the equipment there. In the opening of the garment shop up in Fairbanks 2 years ago, we provided the equipment there. So when you say, you know, are we a training program? Are we trying to operate as a profit-making mechanism? Are we a corrections management tool? We're all those things, and depending upon which of the eight industries you look at, some are more successful than others in various areas.
Yeah, getting back to working yourself out of a job, if we were to delete this program totally, how many jobs would be lost in this Juneau area as administrators in this particular program?
There are two production managers in my own position.
Three people. The other question I have is, I'm a little confused whether or not, what's the main thrust of the, is it to create a work environment, or is it to train people, or is it just to keep them doing something, or a little of each?
And this is pretty much nationwide. It would be great to find that perfect industry that is not in competition with any private sector, that provides a tremendous work opportunity for after the inmate getting out. It would cost $1,000 to get into and employ 150 inmates. I've never found that industry or even come close to it. Basically, the training value that we're providing is that some of the people that we have in prison, obviously, have never had real jobs. So just to have them into a work ethic type situation where they have to get up, have to report to somebody, have to do some type of quality in their work that they're performed, and they get paid some type of money, which they're developed some type of financial responsibility. Coping in a realistic environment is probably the most important skill that we provide, because most of them have never had regular full-time jobs. Also, working how to work with any piece of equipment, safety regulations surrounding that piece of equipment are transferable skills to other type industries. The work ethic, as I said before, would accustom the inmates to regular work, and certainly we're very much interested in utilizing the TIE concept to tie educational programs into our industries and trying to get union certifications for a lot of our programs, because I think that's a really important key for those inmates after they get out to have an opportunity to get another job. Nationwide, and there hasn't been done any recidivism studies in the state of Alaska because they're quite expensive, but there have been at least two completed, two are currently underway, and the figure that I have heard tossed around is it reduces recidivism by about 25%.
So I would assume then that the primary goal of this program is not really to train somebody for a job so they get out and go to work. It's a work ethic and environment in the workplace more that's the most important.
I guess not. Not the most important, maybe not that terminology. It probably happens more than any other goal that we have. But I think you'd be somewhat correct.
Well, tell me, then, how do you train a person for a job without going into competition with the private sector?
That's the difficulty. And I think we would probably do more of that training if we weren't in competition with the private sector. And to some extent, I think we do. Certainly the auto body shop, that person, when he gets out, could go to work in any type of auto body shop in Alaska and have.
Mr. Chairman, I would just comment that you can provide training without competing with the private sector. And I think this is kind of one of those ideas. It's been around for a long, long time. And certainly I would say that it does have some value in terms of perhaps keeping them occupied, but I think that we might serve them better by providing them some real training that really makes them employable when they leave.
I've got a question. How do we do that?
Well, what you have essentially going on in the prison system at this time is what are basically on-the-job training programs, which can be helpful, but they don't necessarily get somebody in the door. Now, if you certify somebody, then that gives them a little bit of a credential that they can get into somebody's door. But there isn't any reason that you cannot provide training programs for the inmates that can be contained probably within the same facilities that you are using. You could do other things with them. But you could train people and train them for a bunch of different jobs so that wherever they go, they have a good chance of working. And you do that by providing a broad-based variety of training programs that may or may not require on-the-job training, which is currently what you're doing now. But you can do that without competing with the private sector, and you can do it. It's done all the time in this state and through a variety of different agencies. They provide training programs for people who have different problems, and they do that without displacing anyone. And the displacement that you'll have will be on down the line when those people go out in the labor market and they take jobs. But the programs that we have currently, that's my field. And the current programs that we have within our correctional system are really outmoded and outdated, and I don't think they really serve the inmates to the degree that they should or could.
Madam Chair, if I could respond.
Yes, come on.
We do, of course, offer a range of vocational and education programs. I'm not as familiar with those as I should be. We try to incorporate those in with industry wherever possible. We have a situation where we have a computer-assisted design training program, training on computer to design furniture or office layouts or whatever. We have incorporated that into our furniture operation. Granted, there may be only one or two people that are employed in that function within our furniture operation, but in every instance that we have the opportunity, we try to incorporate the vocational training programs, which again, I'm not as familiar with as correctional industries, and there are a full range of those. I recently looked at some of the ones that were offered out in the remote facilities, and they were somewhat, I thought, useful for trying to approach jobs in the private sector.
I'll just give you an example. This is a response to Senator Halford's question, but right now we have Charter College, which is in Anchorage, which is providing a variety of vocational technical programs at the cost, I think, of about Tuition runs about $6,000 for the entire program. So at the end of the program, you are employable. They have a 95% employment success for their graduates. And I would say if you took that $6,000 and you compared that with what it's costing us per inmate to do these programs, you probably find that we're spending a heck of a lot more than $6,000, and they're not being trained to the degree that they can leave that program as they do with the charter college programs and enter the labor market. And that's a concern that I have. If it's a make-work program to keep them busy so they don't riot, that's fine, let's call it that. But let's not let anyone think that we're training these people to go out and be active in the labor market, because we are not. And we're doing them a real disservice by pretending that we are.
Well, you know, that's all and well, but unfortunately they don't have a great constituency in that jailhouse. We can't even get enough money to build them a new jailhouse unless the court's forced to do that. So I think the feelings of the people out who are outside are not too sympathetic about spending $6,000 per inmate to teach them. I think they're more willing to have them work and work their way through at probably no expense to state if we can possibly do it. But I think that idea breaks down when it comes to funding.
Well, the point that I'm trying to make, Senator, is that we are already spending more money than that to keep this program going. If you broke it down and per inmate cost, you'd find that it probably we're spending just as much money. And I'm saying the money that we're spending on this could probably be better spent.
Commissioner, did you have a comment?
Well, I think there's several things here that we've haven't even addressed. First, I'd like to ask, has each one of you visited the institution?
Pardon me?
Have either one of you or all of you visited the institutions, three or four of them?
I visited two.
Two of them? No, three of them.
I visited two.
You and I were in one.
Sorry, I took you back.
Well,
I
made a few notes here that the words provide, and it's not what you're actually doing. Now, I come from the outside onto the inside, I guess I've been accused of, but I've been in business for Alaska for 42 years, come this June. And I find what you're actually telling me, Senator Collins, is not what we are attempting to do. The main thing is the inmate has, for morale, teaches responsibility to work with others, to follow orders, motivation, pride in accomplishing a job, on-time performance, in other words, getting something done at a specific time, which most of these people have never had that in their life, does away with idleness, ultimately protects the public with busy hands, lowers recidivism, which is what the whole industry is about, reduces cost. And I've never heard anyone say anything in regards to a product that is made in Alaska and used by Alaskans. I made several times a statement that I would be willing to bet almost any amount of money that if you were paying 3 or 4 mils on your personal property to fund the correctional institution, there would be a lot more people concerned about what is really happening. The other thing is that I received by going to a seminar just a week or 10 days ago, that in the 10 to 12 years from now, the United States, including all 50 states, will commit to approximately $500 billion in corrections. And I couldn't believe it. I asked the question, how do you come up with that figure? We have so many people now that are using crack. We have so many bursts. We have so many things that we know that is causing us our problem. We haven't even scratched the surface yet of what it's going to be. I could not believe those figures, but this is what was told. The other thing is the use of those people in there. My wife went with me to Spring Creek several weeks ago, and when we got out of there, she said, I don't think I want to go back into another one with you. There's a different tension that's in there, and there was a lot of idleness in there. And I have asked five or six Native leaders, tell me, what is it that we can do with the 35% of the corrections that are Alaskan natives. We can't teach them the small motors. We can't teach them because we're competing against something. And I'm going to take a different approach from this type of thing and get more into another phase of it instead of competing. I have a brother-in-law that it was in the corrections at Walla Walla that was the instructor on body and offender. He left that because he did not like the looks in the eyes of a couple of them. He went to work at the Walla Walla Community College, which he now heads, that particular department. But basically, those people that have any type of a job and follow the orders, the motivation, and this is a thing that really gets me in regards to our younger people, that we restrict them from doing work. And they do not know how to follow orders. They do not know how to motivate. They don't know anything at all about what is going on. And this is what these people are in there, in the institution for. They've never had that opportunity. I've talked with several of them. I'm green at this, but I can certainly understand when I go into it to see the opportunity of what happens. So if we make it in Alaska to be used in Alaska, I look at that as being a positive instead of being made in Georgia or made in North Carolina or made in South Carolina, and someone made $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $10,000, $15,000, $50,000 off from whatever it is that we're selling. Brazil, I recently visited, which I was absolutely amazed at what Brazil does. They passed a law that you